ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In 2007, four people vanished. It was dubbed a death cult. But after months of investigation, I don't think it's that simple. I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, The Nan Up 4, a story of people drawn into a 20-year saga they didn't ask for, who have spent decades trying to reconcile the choices they made that led them here.
The family lived a bizarre alternative lifestyle.
Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on Big Ideas, how tyrants fall. Hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell. Yes, today's show has as its backdrop the death of that very famous tyrant of our time, who until this month ruled over Iran for the last 36 years, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. You're about to meet political scientist Dr. Marcel Dersus, author of How Tyrants Fall and How Nations Survive. He has deep insights into how dictators and despots come unstuck, the very strategies that tyrants use to seize and stay in power can also form the foundation of their ultimate downfall. Dr. Dersus is a non-resident fellow at the Institute for Security Policy at Keele University and a member of the Standing Expert Committee on Terrorism and Interior Security at the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung in Germany. As democracies falter around the world and authoritarian regimes gain traction, this lecture, How Tyrants Rise and Fall, recorded live at the Sydney Writers' Festival on Gadigal Country, is a must listen.
I've long been interested in the topic, I suppose in part because I am German. So as a topic, it's been a little difficult to avoid. But also I've had a personal experience with it that I think turned that interest into something of an obsession. So when I was at university, I told myself that I would definitely not do a doctorate. Right? I was sitting in these libraries and it was dusty and I had enough. You know, I wanted to go out there, I wanted to explore the world, I wanted to see something different. So I asked around a little bit, and eventually I was offered a job working for a brewery in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Naturally, I took it because it was the logical next step. And as you can probably imagine, my family was thrilled. My mother was super excited. Here I was, you know, the son going off to Africa to brew beer for some reason. And I wanted to get away from politics. I wanted to, you know, think about something else and see something different. But when I was in the Congo, a coup attempt happened in the capital city of Kinshasa. And even though I was very far away on the other side of the country in a city called Lubumbashi, I kind of felt the impact of that in a very direct way. So I was on my way to work, and ordinarily this would have been one of the best parts of the day. You know, it was calm, there were these exotic birds, these wonderful palm trees, and it was just kind of magical. You know, it's fair to say that Lubumbashi is not the prettiest city or the greenest city, but that was a great part of the day. So I walked to the brewery, very calm, very relaxed, and all of a sudden I hear a shot. And then I hear another shot and another shot. And then I hear an explosion. And not only that, but the shots came from three different directions. Standing here now, I'd love to be able to say that I was super cool about it, right? No problem. Oh, there's some shooting. Whatever, that's fine. I was so scared. Because I was in the Congo, which is far away from home. You know, the nearest German embassy would have been more than 1,000 kilometers away. And I knew that if things were going to go really wrong, I also wouldn't be able to fly out because the airport's closed. So I turn around and I talk to one of my colleagues and I say, look, what is going on? What are we going to do? And he just looks at me and he just says, nothing. We're going to do nothing. You know, there's been shooting before and it was fine. So it's probably going to be okay again. And I was like, what? Really, that day has always stayed with me because I couldn't understand how some people could be so numb to this type of political instability. But it just happened so frequently that they almost got used to it in a way. Ever since then, I've been asking myself, how do these people stay in power Why do you have these military coups? How do they succeed? When do they fall? And how do you get rid of these types of leaders? And I found out later what had happened was that the coup plotters had attacked in the capital city of Kinshasa. But the coup plotters were from Lubumbashi. So after the plotters had attacked in the capital, the government was hitting back in Lubumbashi. So I go back to Germany, I eat my schnitzels, you know, I calm down a little bit, and then obviously I did do that PhD. And I wrote it about this topic. And then eventually, that's sort of where the book came from. I want to start by maybe clearing up a bit of a misconception. So looking at these types of leaders, these tyrants, these despots from our democracies, you can get the sense that they're almost invulnerable, that they can do whatever they want on any given day. You know, they just snap their finger, and whatever it is that they desire just magically happens. And they're really, there's nobody that challenges them in any way. But that's not how it works. Every political leader needs others in order to stay in power. The question is, how many other people do you need? And who exactly do you need? So in a functioning democracy like Australia, you need a large share of the population on your side in order to take power and to maintain it. And the reason for that is that you need to win elections. In a system like North Korea, somebody like Kim Jong-un, the dictator, will only need maybe 200 or 300 families. And these would be the generals, the intelligence officials, the advisors, even the people closest to him, his very own family. And just about the vast majority of the population is more or less irrelevant for the survival of his regime. When you hear that, at first, it can sound quite good. You know, you have a lot of room for maneuver. You can do more things than democratic leaders could because you can ignore all of these people. But very often what tyrants find is that it can become a trap. Because if you're a democratically elected leader, like your prime minister, you can afford to lose a lot of supporters. If you lose, you know, 100,000 supporters, 200,000 supporters, so what? Right? Like if the election is not tomorrow, you can make up for them. You can find new people to support you. But if somebody like Vladimir Putin loses 50 of the wrong people, there's a very good chance that he's going to lose power. And the added problem for these leaders is what happens to them once they do lose that power. Because if we look at democratically elected leaders again, usually after they lose power, they're perfectly fine. So, I don't know, they might start to play golf, or they will give speeches to banks, or maybe they will just enjoy retirement with their families. But when political scientists looked at what happens to personless dictators after they lose power, they found that more than two-thirds of them are either forced into exile, imprisoned, or killed. So you're in a situation whereby you could lose power at any moment if the people closest to you turn on you. And if you do lose that power, you may not just lose the power, but also your freedom or even your life. So the incentives that you have are very, very different, and it's not nearly as comfortable as many of us would think it is. Now, a second thing that you may have noticed is that a lot of these leaders are deeply, deeply weird, right? They are not normal people in any way. There's a Turkmen dictator who constructed a statue of himself in gold that rotated around the sun. When Muammar Gaddafi, the Libyan dictator, would travel abroad to, let's say, Paris, he would take his all-female bodyguard with him, and he would snake through the city in 100 cars, because that's how big his entourage was. You know, he would meet guests, even in Paris, in a Bedouin tent that he took him with himself to meet people in the desert tradition. And, of course, these types of people are narcissists, right? Their brains are deeply damaged. They love themselves, and they conflate their country with themselves. And they have no empathy. You know, they will have a completely normal conversation with somebody over lunch, and then in the evening, they'll order their death. And they're doing it with some regularity. But an uncomfortable truth is that while these people are not normal, and they would be, you know, terrible co-workers, you know, in an ordinary office environment, you know, you got Saddam Hussein sitting next to you, you know, it wouldn't be great. They do have some rationality. they are often rational within the system in which they operate. You know, in the system in which they work, it can be rational to torture. It can be rational to kill. And the reason why I say that is because when tyrants do lose their rationality, very often they lose power extremely quickly. So one example for this would be a dictator named Marcias Nguema, who ruled a small West African country during the Cold War. And he lost it. Like, really, really lost it. You know, he would walk around his palace screaming out the names of the people that he had killed. You know, he knew that there was something wrong with him because when he was in Spain once, on a trip abroad, he saw a psychiatrist and he wanted to get treated. But his issue was that every suitable doctor that could have treated him at home in West Africa had either fled his regime or the regime had killed them. So he was struggling, and I mean really struggling, and nobody was there to take care of him. And one evening, he asked his servants to lay the table for 8 guests. Nobody arrived, but he spent the entire evening talking to his guests as if they were there. So things are going very well for him at this point, and not just because he's ill. Because the problem, as seen from the dictatorial palace, is that this is going to make the people around you extremely nervous. And they were so nervous because they thought, you know, if he can no longer differentiate between friend and foe, they could be next, because he was killing essentially at random. So very quickly, the generals, the intelligence officials that kept him in power, decided to topple him and shoot him because they didn't want to be shot. We have this uncomfortable idea that they're necessarily nuts, and some of them are, but most of them are not. They just operate in a very, very different environment. Maybe something else that could be of interest is that really these leaders see threats all around. They're somewhat paranoid, and they are right to be paranoid because there are many threats. But their problem is that they can't really make those threats go away. They can just push them around. You know, they can maybe alleviate one problem, but then they create another problem in the process. And let me explain what I mean by that. So one of the primary threats to just about every tyrant is their military. They always have to be almost more scared of their own soldiers than somebody else's soldiers. Because you can carry out a coup d'etat with very few people. You know, you need maybe 200, maybe 300 people, and you can get rid of these terrible leaders in many, many instances. This makes these leaders extremely nervous. So one of the things that they do is to change the structure of their military and of their security services. So oftentimes, in a functioning democracy, you just have a regular military. In these types of systems, you have a regular military, but also some sort of parallel military force, maybe a party-based militia, or maybe mercenaries. And then you also have something like a militarized palace guard. And the reason why dictators and other tyrants do this is because they want to send a signal to the generals in charge of the regular military that they would have to go through the militia, or that they would have to go through that militarized palace guard to get rid of them. And that in turn makes it less likely that that general is going to try it on a random Tuesday, because he doesn't want to die, so he doesn't take that risk. And once you have done this, and almost all of them do it, you know, pick a tyrant, they're doing it, right? You do the same thing with your intelligence services. You don't just have one intelligence service watching everybody in the country. You split it up, you make it 3. And once you're done with that, you make sure that they not only compete with one another, but they also have overlapping responsibilities. So they are also watching each other. Because again, you are most worried about the people closest to you, and that includes the agents, and that includes your own soldiers. You know, presumably, when dictators do this, they feel quite clever and quite good about themselves, because they have now successfully reduced the threat of their own military getting rid of them. But as it were, if you're a tyrant, nothing comes for free. And the problem with this type of setup, which is often called coup-proofing, is that by making coups less likely, you make it more difficult for these security services to do their actual job, which is fighting wars and finding out things. And when a war then does happen, you have simply not equipped these people to do their job. So If you look at something like Russia's invasion of Ukraine, for example, initially the Russians were really struggling and a lot of people had really overestimated the force of the Russian military. And in part, that is because the Russian military is not built to fight an actual war. It is constructed in a way to keep Vladimir Putin in power by making it more difficult for his own soldiers to get rid of him. And that is why you have random Chechens involved, and you have mercenaries, and you have the regular military and the National Guard, and it's just, that's not how you do it. That's not how you win an actual war. Another thing that I want to mention is that oftentimes these types of leaders lose power at the precise moment when they can almost seem the strongest. And that is because these regimes are built on an impression of inevitability. So if you're that absolute monarch, you know, if you're that despot, you want people to believe that there is no alternative. It's just you. There are no other leaders that could be in charge. Definitely not going to have a democracy. It is just you. It's just Assad. It's just Gaddafi. That's it. Nothing else is on offer. But when people get the sense that perhaps there could be an alternative, oftentimes these leaders lose power extremely quickly. You know, one of the things that was so fascinating when Bashar al-Assad fell, for example, is that in Damascus, his own soldiers, once they came to the realization that he was genuinely struggling and that he could actually fall, literally took off their uniforms, threw them to the side of the road, and just went home. Because there is no genuine loyalty. You know, there's no legitimacy. The vast majority of these people don't think that somebody like Assad is a great leader, you know, who pushes the country forward and who makes people more prosperous, because he doesn't. So that is why dictators and all kinds of tyrants always have to look strong. And this is something that dissidents can use to their advantage. So one of the things I became really fascinated by was nonviolent protest during my research. And it is such a curious thing, because on the one hand, you have, you know, school teachers, you have teenagers, you have pensioners, and there's not a single gun in sight. They don't even have Molotov cocktails. And they're squaring up against these entrenched dictatorships. And they have tanks, and they have planes, and now they have drones, and all the rest of it. And yet, oftentimes, the nonviolent protesters can win. So how does that work? In essence, it is using this idea, this importance of inevitability, against the dictatorship. So if you bring people out into the streets, if you manage to mobilize them, the dictatorship has to react because they cannot look weak. So usually, as you find people in the squares, they give an order to, you know, use some violence to try to beat them home. But the problem is that it is rarely popular to beat women and children or pensioners or also teenagers. So the very next day, you might have even more people in the streets. And now that you have 1 million, 2 million, 3 people in the streets, the only solution that you can possibly have is lethal force. So you're no longer sending in the police with, you know, batons or truncheons, but now you have a choice to make. Are you going to give an order to fire or are you not? And this, you know, in German, sometimes we call this a choice between the plague and cholera, okay? So at this point, when you have these crowds, there are no more good options. You pick the plague, not great, or you pick cholera, also not exactly amazing. And it is at this precise moment, when the regime can seem the strongest, that the regime falls. And it works in two ways. The first thing that often happens is that, you know, just because you give an order to fire doesn't mean that anybody is actually going to shoot. And often the very simple, the ordinary soldiers, the ordinary policemen, they just refuse because they don't want to shoot at their neighbors. They don't want to risk shooting at their friends or perhaps even their family. And when that happens, after you've given the order, everything goes to hell because you are no longer in control at all. So a bad situation turns apocalyptic for the dictator. And the second mechanism by which it works is because the elite splits. And this is something that I looked at in the context of communist East Germany. I was born in 1990 in Hamburg in West Germany. So, you know, admittedly, East Germany, like the idea of a communist society existing in East Germany was completely alien to me. I mean, it might as well could have been in a different universe. You know, that's how little I thought about it. But for the book, I met a dissident, and he told me about a day in Leipzig in 1989. What happened is that the regime knew that a big, big protest was planned against the regime. And they desperately wanted to prevent it from happening. Because again, when you have people in the street, you have to react in some way, and you want to avoid that. So the best thing for you to happen is for people to not even get out into the streets in the first place. So they pulled out all the stops. I mean, they really tried everything. They literally threatened people with a Chinese solution, which was very easy to understand at the time because it was shortly after the Chinese had put down people in Beijing. And yet, people did show up. You know, they weren't intimidated. They thought that there could be an alternative. You know, it was a nightmare scenario because all of a sudden more and more and more people turned up. And eventually, the local officials had a decision to make. You know, people were approaching a bend in the road, and if they were going to try to suppress these protests, it would have to happen at this exact moment because there was just too many of them. So the local official got on the phone to Berlin, called a bigwig, and said, "We have a serious problem here. Like, we have to decide. It's now or never. Either we shoot these people or we let them pass. What do you want me to do?" And that bigwig in Berlin said, "Let me get back to you. I'm going to call you back." And the official in Leipzig, he waited and waited and waited, and weirdly enough, he never called back. And the reason for that is that this bigwig in Berlin didn't want to be the person to make that call. He didn't want to be responsible for, you know, thousands of people dying at the hands of their own security forces. So the official had to make a decision by himself, and he also didn't want to be that guy. So he let him pass. And the dissident that I spoke to was an incredibly brave man. You know, he had been harassed by the notorious Stasi, and even on that day, he was trying to dodge the agents. But eventually, he had found a place atop a church tower after a local pastor had, after some hesitation, allowed him to go up. And he filmed the whole thing. And not only did he film it, but he managed to get it smuggled to Western Germany. And eventually it was shown on West German television. And because it's so close geographically, millions of people in Eastern Germany could then see that people had risen up and that they had been brave enough to challenge the regime. That was the beginning of the end. Yeah, after that, they were lost because then they had more and more protests and it just became impossible to put them all down. So these regimes can almost fracture under the weight of their own repression. I want to make sure that I leave you with something a little more cheerful, maybe, because I'm conscious there's a lot of, you know, death and misery. While doing this research, I have become more and more optimistic. And I know in a way that sounds weird, because, you know, there's still a lot of dictators about and they wreak havoc and they kill their own people. But I have now spent so much time looking at the weaknesses of these regimes that I've become more and more convinced in the future of our own system. I think there are three principal reasons. The first one is people want to be free. People want to have a say in the way that they are governed. They want to have an influence. They don't just want some other guy, you know, 10,000 kilometers away making decisions for them. It's just not who we are. And now the genie is almost out of the bottle. Because if you think through human history, it is mostly a history of tyrants. You know, tyranny or democracy was not really a choice. There was always a tyrant. And when one tyrant went, there'd just be another. And it would be a bishop or a chieftain or a dictator or a king, but there was always some tyrant. But now we know that there's an alternative and people are willing to risk things for it, sometimes even their life. The second thing is that structure that we are talking about at the beginning. So you know how in a democracy you need a lot of people in order to maintain power. That makes a massive, massive, massive difference because our politicians need to do some good things for us some of the time. Not because they love us or because they're necessarily good people, but just because they want power. And to get power and to maintain power, they have to build that school. They have to build that hospital. They have to build that road. And that's completely different in these other countries. If you have Vladimir Putin and $1 million comes in, it is stupid to use that money to improve the lives of ordinary Russians. It is irrational, it is actively irrational to build a hospital somewhere in Siberia. To stay in power, what Putin has to do is to take that money and give it to the oligarchs, or give it to the spies, or give it to the generals. So we have a structural advantage. Life is easier in our systems for ordinary voters because votes matter. And in these systems, they do not. And the last thing that makes me hopeful is that we have the ability to course correct. When things go wrong, when our leaders mess up, as they often do, we have a good way to get rid of them. You know, every couple of years, you get to go to the ballot box, or I guess in this country, you have to go to the ballot box, right? Yeah, it's different in Germany, but you have to go to the ballot box and you can make a choice. If they did a good job, you try to keep them around, and if they didn't, you vote them out of office. And this is something that none of these systems have. So sometimes people ask me, oh, but can't life be nice in a dictatorship? It can be. For some people, it is. But the problem is that there's no guarantee that it's going to stay that way. So yes, you can imagine some benevolent dictator, you know, doing good things for his people out of the kindness of his heart. But what if he doesn't anymore? What if he changes his mind? What if there's somebody else? There's just no recourse. I mean, apart from, you know, killing him or coups and, you know, all the rest of it. But essentially, if you live in a dictatorship, you have to gamble on the goodwill of these people. And we don't, because we can get rid of them. And that makes me incredibly optimistic. I'm going to stop now. If I don't stop now, I'm going to go on and on. So let it be this.
German political scientist, author of How Tyrants Fall and How Nations Survive, Marcel Dursis. And this talk was recorded live at the Sydney Writers' Festival. Natasha Mitchell joining you on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. Find all our episodes on ABC Listen. Hitler in Nazi Germany, Pol Pot in Cambodia, Serbia's Slobodan Milosevic, the Russian army in Ukraine under Putin, tyrants and their loyalists commit horrific crimes against humanity. How must they be held accountable? And if or when they are, does that make a difference to their victim survivors? Really important questions considered at this 2025 Adelaide Writers' Week event, led by Australia's former Foreign Minister and former President and CEO of the International Crisis Group, Gareth Evans. He's joined by prominent Australian-British barrister Geoffrey Robertson, whose latest book is called World of War Crimes. Tobias Buck, managing editor of the Financial Times and author of Final Verdict, a Holocaust trial in the 21st century. And playwright, director and author of Hewa Rwanda, Letter to the Absent, Dorsey Ragumba. Dorsey survived the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, where more than 800,000 people, mostly ethnic Tutsis, were butchered. And Gareth is starting with Dorsey.
You were in the country at the time, and most of your own immediate family were tragically among the very first victims of that murderous rampage. I won't ask you to relive, unless you want to share that with us, that indescribable horror of that experience. But I do want to ask you how it could ever be possible for you or anyone else like you to engage in any kind of process of reconciliation with those who perpetrated that horror. How is it possible?
Yeah, it's a very complex question. Reconciliation is something, a very beautiful word, but the situation is different. It depends. I think for me, reconciliation is a necessity if we talk about the country itself. A country like Rwanda, which is a very old country, a monoculture society, and the country itself was completely fallen apart with the genocide, after the genocide. And it was a necessity for the country to reconcile in itself, which our own history, to think how to, from there, from that the situation after the genocide, to move forward. It was interesting. But when we talk about individuals, survivors, for example, reconciliation is a very difficult concept. Just after the genocide, in many churches and for different opinion leaders, was just calling for forgiveness. Just after, And forgiveness, you can forgive someone who steals a bicycle or something like that. But a neighbor who butchered completely all your family, it's a very huge price to ask to survivors. I think survivors, they have many challenges. One of them is to accept the unacceptable situation and to deal with the pain. And forgiveness can be, for me, mandatory. And the other problem for me about the concept of reconciliation is I think it's in a situation of war. We have two parties just fighting each other, in a civil war, for example. But when you talk about a crime against humanity, we are not in a situation of war. We are in something completely different. And there is no such as two groups fighting each other. They are really perpetrators and victims. And to ask victims just to reconcile with the perpetrators, it's really something really... I think we need another word. We need another process. In Africa, most of the time, when it's about political violence, immediately come to mind, it's two tribes who are killing each other. But actually, it's not the situation. The situation is there is victims, and in the middle of the society, in the middle of the country, a group, a political group, were organized, who a government who turned criminal and targeted one part of the population. That's why I don't, for me, just it's a very personal opinion, reconciliation is not the process I have.
I can think we can all understand the intensity of the emotion that you must feel and you've described so well. But you've also acknowledged, I know, the absolute necessity to somehow move on, to engage in a process of national and community healing, even in relation to neighbours in the same villages who are responsible for butchering other family. Mm-hmm. What, in your experience and judgment, is the most effective mechanism, means, process for managing that national healing, that community healing? Are there effective strategies that you've seen at work in Rwanda?
Yeah. We are talking about ideological crime. And before the blows, I may say, there are a storytelling in itself, an ideology. In Rwanda, what the government tried is just to erase ethnic groups in all documents, saying there is no Hutus, there is no Tutsis, there is just only Rwandans. And I think it was a really very good step, first step, just for new generation of Rwandans, to give them the opportunity to live in a different society. And the one also most important thing for me is the justice process. This is a very important step because the society have, there is a need, the trials, the tribunal, it's a place for justice, but it's also a place to talk, to have a room for the survivor to speak about, to give his testimony to perpetrators also. It was really important. In Rwanda, they experienced a kind of local justice called Gacaca, maybe.
Jeffrey, you've been a very consistent advocate for the criminal prosecution through all available avenues, including some international courts specially created for that purpose, one of which, Sierra Leone, you presided over. For criminal prosecution of perpetrators of crimes against humanity, an end to impunity for those who manifestly deserve justice. But to what extent do you think there's any chance of that cutting across, that need for reconciliation that Dorsey has spoken of, the need for healing of desperately ravaged communities? Does bringing criminals to account through a formal judicial process, perhaps as distinct from the community processes, the Gacaca process that Dorsey has described, does bringing criminals to account in a formal process really make any difference to their victims? Is there a case for more South African-style truth and reconciliation commissions, or should everyone who deserves it suffer real punishment? Jeffrey.
I still think there's a lot of truth in the slogan, no peace without justice. because that has been the experience and the legacy of the Nuremberg trials, the great trial after the Second World War, is still of relevance. The importance of Nuremberg was not so much the conviction of the Nazi leaders, certainly not their rather shameful today execution. It was the fact that the judgment at Nuremberg is prevented Holocaust denial getting underway throughout Europe. It is a judgment that laid the ghost of the Nazi crimes, and is that is one of the most important features still of international justice, providing, as only the legal process can, by cross-examination and by analysis, close analysis, what really happened, because always there are myths, the sort of thing that Putin's propagandists are putting about at the moment about Ukraine. So that is my first point. In Rwanda provides a nice example of the tension between retribution and deterrence through international law, because Rwanda initially, when it, under Kagame, of course, who'd fought the war, wanted to execute the main criminals, the authors of the genocide. That couldn't be done under international law. We had to set up a court in Arusha, in Tanzania, to prosecute the perpetrators under an international law that didn't provide the death penalty, because that is banned under international law. And in the result, of course, Rwanda finally succumbed to pressure and abolished the death penalty and had the grass courts that you speak of. I wasn't satisfied that the grass courts were entirely fair, because they, if you pleaded guilty, you got 7 years. If you pleaded not guilty and were convicted, as most were, you got 14 years. And so that was a sort of pressure. But nonetheless, they served a purpose, and a valuable purpose, of providing reconciliation within Rwanda. And now, of course, we have the great irony, which I went through, certainly my chambers did, when we tried to stop successfully the British Conservative government from putting our asylum, sending our asylum seekers to Rwanda, that under Kagame, it was not a safe place, as the court finally ruled, for asylum seekers, and it's now supporting the M23 group, which is causing death and devastation in the Congo. So there you have one of the great ironies of crimes against humanity today. Does the relatively successful result of dealing with the perpetrators, the Hutu power people, does that in the end create a society which is opposed to and which shrinks from such actions as supporting the M23? But there are other issues, of course, that come up in Rwanda. There was the case, it's now perhaps a classic case, of the man who ran Radio Mill Colleen, which would incite every morning to genocide. The grave is only half full. Who will help us fill it? He stayed away for 20 years and was then hauled out of Paris, finally to face justice. And, of course, he was too ill from dementia from the time he was brought forward to be prosecuted. So that also raises questions as to the length of time. But nonetheless, his prosecution, the mills of justice grind slowly, but they grind exceedingly small. This man who was perhaps the most important progenitor of the genocide in Rwanda that killed 800,000 people, finally ended up too sick in mind to be prosecuted. Was it worthwhile? I think it was.
I want to come back to Tobias now, because the discussion so far has proceeded on the assumption that we know who deserves punishment for perpetrating crimes against humanity. But is the issue really as clear-cut as all that? You've written in this marvellous book, Final Verdict, about the bringing to trial in Germany nearly seven decades later of a concentration camp guard who, as such, of course, participated in and helped enable the Holocaust, but who actually harmed no one directly himself and was acknowledged to be, in court, the smallest of small cogs in the whole enterprise. Was that prosecution justified? What is the responsibility of those at the lowest end of the chain of command? What might any of us have done in that guard's place? Tobias?
I think in legal terms, the answer to that question is fairly straightforward. In Germany, murder does not fall under the statute of limitations. Murder does not expire. So, yes, you can and you will be put on trial for murder, even a lifetime after the deed. The question of prosecuting and ultimately punishing those who are mere helpers or accessories in such terrible crimes, I think is an extraordinary, fascinating one. And having sat through most of this trial, it became clear to me that it was, in some ways, exactly the insignificance of the defendant, born or die, that I found unsettling. Because when we look at the people who sat in the dock in Nuremberg or the Eichmann trial, I think it's quite easy for us to tell ourselves that we would never have acted in that way. There is a sort of consolation of distance. We are not like them. I think it is far more difficult looking at the contribution, the minor contribution that camp guards like Born or Die did to distance ourselves from this. And I think in terms of what we can learn from such trials for our politics, our societies, our democracies today, the importance for everyone involved in state-sponsored atrocities to say no, I think is an extraordinarily important lesson to emerge from such trials. And perhaps one final point about why these trials matter even seven decades later, I think it's important to look at it from the victim's perspective as well. So this late flurry of Holocaust trials that we've seen in Germany since 2011 has allowed many survivors of the Holocaust to appear in court and tell their story for the first time, and to not just be heard and even name the victims, their families who perished in the camps, but also to make an active contribution to seeing one of their tormentors brought to justice. So I think these trials, even seven decades later, even of people whose functional responsibility was fairly low, are of extraordinary importance and frankly can give us a lot to think about and to learn for our behaviours today.
Dorsey, would you like to comment on that from a victim's perspective? Should there be some kind of time limit on bringing these people to justice?
Sure. Yeah. As I said, it's very the right place for the victims just to tell their story. And for me now, we are three decades after the genocide. Those stories are really, really important because victims of genocide, of such a crimes, who are really spectacular, tend to disappear totally, to become numbers. Like in Rwanda, we know that 1 million people have been killed. After their death, they tend to disappear, even their existence in itself. And on theater, on stage, I directed a play which was really meaningful for us. And that's how also the experience of justice can be helpful in every situation. This play called Investigation was about the first trial in Germany called the Trial for Auschwitz. It was in 64 in Frankfurt. The first time the German was prosecuting German couples and with victims, and the first time for victims of survivors of Auschwitz to speak It was really different to the Nuremberg trials. Nuremberg was such a big state and a big, big fish of Nazi party. But here it was just a less level of responsibilities. But it was a really important situation for victims just to come and to speak their own story. And one writer, German writer, Peter Weiss, wrote a verbatim work play, beautiful. And we used this experience of Germany when started in Rwanda, the Gacaca process. And there was really similarities between those situations. Because in Rwanda, we faced different nature of trial. There was international trials in Arusha. But in Rwanda, what we call Gacaca means a yard, yeah, grass yard. And victims, for the first time, come to meet, sometimes they are the killers, and to speak. And this speak was really important because it was the first time, for example, to ask where are the remains of their loved ones. And this is really a big, big issue. And to have an answer, yes, there is the question of justice, but also to have the truth to emerge.
Turning the emphasis from looking backward, albeit drawing lessons for the future from the past, yeah. Can we just focus now on what are the most effective strategies now for preventing, halting mass atrocity crimes in the future? In an age of Security Council paralysis, conspicuous violations, as we've all acknowledged, of international humanitarian law by countries like Russia and Israel, in an environment of this abandonment of moral decency by Trump's America, including, and to me, one of the most appalling things, and no doubt to you, Jeffrey, imposing sanctions on International Criminal Court prosecutors acting wholly within the letter and the spirit of their mandates. Add to that the growing prevalence, not just in the United States, of populist, nationalist political leaders like Trump. How can we energise? How can we best energise international commitment to preventing and halting these crimes? Is it through primarily the International Criminal Court process, the prospect of prosecution? Is it through multilateral treaties and institutions, human rights councils and so on? Is it through bottom-up community campaigning, including sort of consciousness raising through the kind of theatre and popular culture initiatives that Dorsey has been promoting? Is it something else? I'll start with you, Jeffrey, but I'd like the both of you to comment on that too.
It's going to be difficult, isn't it, for the next 4 years to do anything with the International Criminal Court. It's going to persevere with the quite rightful case against Netanyahu and the Trump administration, which means the United States is going to try to destroy the International Criminal Court. It tried that 4 years ago at the end of Trump's regime. It failed. This time it will use everything it can, including that benighted remnant of Jesse Helms, the Bomb the Hague Act, the American Ex-Servicemen's Protection Act, which is still in force, which authorizes the president to bomb the Hague and to bomb Denmark if the International Criminal Court captures one American torturer. But I think there is only a way in which Australia can participate. I mean, when Trump announced these absurd sanctions stopping the ICC prosecutor of going to the United Nations to report on what he's doing, 79 countries, including Britain, France and Germany, said that they were utterly supportive of the ICC, notwithstanding the American president's executive order. And Australia was silent. It was sad that it didn't add its name. Maybe DFAT was sleeping, I don't know. But it has at least come out after the United Nations vote when America sided with Russia to avoid the criticism for starting the war in Ukraine. It may be that our best bet is to rely on the old Roman habit of ostracism, that we don't allow Russians to compete in the Australian Open. We decry American diplomacy because it can't be trusted any longer. American lawyers who were so important in developing international law systems 10 years ago aren't heard. They've got nothing to say because of Trump. So to make Americans ashamed of the man that the majority of them have elected as president is maybe the way in which the so-called civilized world can show its contempt for the lowlife president and his even lower life assistants that have...
Jeffrey. Well, amen to all of that, but Jeffrey, is any other strategies apart from the legal ones and the UN and Human Rights Council and so on, do you have any faith in any of those institutional mechanisms?
I have faith in the long term, but not in the short term, I fear. I called my book Crimes Against Humanity, The Struggle for Global Justice, and the struggle has, with Trump, got more difficult.
Tobias, do you have any thoughts on most effective strategies in this very difficult environment at the moment?
It is hard to feel anything but despair for the foreseeable future. I do think the ICC is in a terrible bind between, on the one hand, being unable to come under such pressure in terms of prosecuting the crimes committed in Gaza, but then at the same time, of course, the inability of the US and frankly also some European states to act on the decisions and warrants made by the ICC, of course, causes a huge crisis of legitimacy for the ICC from the perspective of the Global South. How to keep the flame alive in the interim? The only other viable avenue, I suppose, is individual nation states pursuing universal jurisdiction cases, as we've seen in the case of Germany, for example, prosecuting Syrian officials for crimes committed under the Assad regime. This is obviously not at all a meaningful substitute for action at the multilateral level, but I suppose in terms of preventing a feeling of total impunity, it would be desirable that more countries prosecute such cases where possible and where appropriate.
Dorsey, do you have anything to add?
I think, yes, we need the international courts, and they are on threat, but also the universal justice. In case of Rwanda, this was really helpful. The first country who started the universal justice was Belgium in Brussels. And the process is still continuing. Even in Europe, many of the big perpetrators was wealthy people, like the owner of the radio, RTLM. And this, I think, the impunity is the one of the sources of the violence. That's how justice can really protect our societies. If people know that even in 3 or 4 decades, you will be held accountable of your actions in your country, or even if you are a fugitive elsewhere, this really, it's a very big warning, and it can protect the societies.
Thank you all in the audience for listening so intently, and may I ask you to join with me in thanking our panellists. Thank you all.
From Adelaide, Writers Week on Kaurna Country, former Australian Foreign Minister, former head of the International Crisis Group, Gareth Evans, joined by Tobias Buck, Managing Editor of the Financial Times and author of Final Verdict, a Holocaust Trial in the 21st Century, barrister Geoffrey Robertson, author of World of War Crimes, playwright, director, genocide survivor, Dorsey Rugumba, author of Hewa, Rwanda, Letter to the Absent. And I'm Natasha Mitchell. If you'd like to join me at an upcoming live event or festival, head to the Big Ideas homepage, scroll on down to be in our audience. Lots coming up. And next on Big Ideas, you can join me with 3 Nobel laureates on one stage. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.